There is a lot of joy language in today's passage of Scripture from Isaiah. You may or may not have heard all of the youth read it from the version of the Message, but you heard Marina read it from the NRSV. And in just a quick glance at the words and phrases and images, you see joy bursting out all over the place. Here's just going down the page. Be glad, rejoice and blossom, blossom abundantly, rejoice with joy and singing, glory and majesty, be strong, do not fear, leap like a deer, the speechless shout for joy, waters break forth, springs in the desert, everlasting joy, come to Zion singing, everlasting joy on their heads. Obtain joy and gladness with sorrow and sigh, fleeing. This is incredible, yes? These 10 verses are chock full of joy, expressions of joy. And the profound reality, which makes this passage even more spectacular, is that these proclamations of joy were not made while the proclaimer was experiencing bright lights in big cities and joy and external circumstances that were phenomenal. Isaiah was not describing what he was seeing all around him. He was proclaiming what he deeply believed was coming and what he had faith was already there but was still hidden. The proclamations were not made in the bright light of day. They were made in deep darkness, in the bleak midwinter, so to speak. And the kind of joy that Isaiah is talking about is not the kind that depends on external circumstances whatsoever. Whether I am financially well off, or whether I'm in perfect health, or whether my marriage is free of conflict, or whether I have the ideal job, or any job at all, or whether we were spared the last storm, or whether poverty and hunger in the world is being eradicated, or whether warring countries finally make peace with each other. By any of these measurements, we would be living in a deeply joy-deprived world right now. There's no question about it. The events in our lives and that are happening in the world affect us deeply, or at least they should. They make us feel, and hopefully they make us act in certain ways. And when something hopeful or positive, something good happens, well, we rejoice in that, and so we should. But the joy that we speak of during Advent is something completely different. This joy is not a feeling, it's an orientation. It's about how we choose to orient our lives and with whom. During the season of Advent, no matter how commercial or crass the marketing, for those of us who seek to live in the way of Jesus, there is an undeniable scent of joy in the air. And what an enticing aroma. The scent of joy leads us down paths that we might not usually tread, even as the scent of joy enhances all of our other senses. Joy to the world is not just an invitation to a party. It is a challenge to live a brand new kind of life. In the days of waiting and preparation and penitence that mark the 4 weeks of Advent, there is one reprieve. On this, the third Sunday of Advent, the church has traditionally shifted from a prayerful preparation to an, okay, let's be joyful mode. The Advent wreath traditionally sports four sprouts, three purple candles and one pink or rose-colored candle. Now, we like to use white candles at Hillside, and we like to add the Christ candle in the middle. But nonetheless, in the traditional way of doing the wreath, the pink candle is traditionally for this, the third Sunday of Advent, aka Gaudete Sunday, meaning a day to rejoice. The pink or rose-colored candle is a pause in the penitential spirit of Advent. It is intentionally a day that we celebrate and rejoice in the wonder of this season. But there's a difference in partying and rejoicing. So feel free to put away your credit cards, your party dishes, and your ugly Christmas sweaters, intentional or not. And instead, let's consider for a few minutes how those of us anticipating the miracle of Christmas may truly and deeply rejoice. We might traditionally light a rose-colored candle as a symbol of our joy, but that doesn't mean that followers of Jesus see the world through any rose-colored haze. In the old traditional Christian calendar, on December 16th, the church celebrated the martyrdom of St. Stephen. And on the 28th of December, the death of all the infants whom Herod had killed. In our entire history, Christmas is a season that has been embedded in tragedy, injustice, and death. Even the story of good old St. Nicholas himself is a story that in the midst of injustice and tragedy, the church responds in some way to be in the midst of it. Because the joy of Christmas belongs in the midst of where evil is known to operate. It's not relegated to the edges, nor is it outside of those circumstances. In the words of Orthodox theologian Alexander Schmemann, in the understanding of the church, sorrow is not replaced by joy, it is transformed into joy. We may well rejoice at the top of our lungs, but we do so on bended knee. We experience the power of God's presence even as we acknowledge the pitfalls of this world. Advent rejoicing is a breath of fresh air as we grasp just a glimpse of God's design for this world and for all of creation. And the magnitude of this divine design is revealed to us in the message of our passage for this morning in Isaiah 35. Much of the first portion of the book of Isaiah, like literally chapters 1 to 39, is a tale of woe, of Israel and Judah's bad behavior, of their defeat and destruction at the hand of their enemies, of approaching exile and despair. But the prophet's gloomy vision has been dotted with glimpses of joy. In the first week of Advent, we looked at Isaiah chapter 2, and we heard of the hope of a new king and the promise of a new kind of ruler. In the second week of Advent, we looked at Isaiah 11, where the prophet described the promise of a new kind of creation, a world filled with the peaceable kingdom, a world transformed by a redeemed relationship with God. Now, on this third Sunday of Advent, as the prophet contemplates the work of God in the world and envisions the road back from ruin for God's people, the mantra that Isaiah offers us is joy. This joy that Isaiah foretells is literally in the air. The wilderness and the dry land shall be glad. The desert shall rejoice and blossom. Like the crocus, it shall blossom abundantly and rejoice with joy and singing. Even as the land itself responds with joy of God's renewed presence, so too the people themselves are transformed with joy. Isaiah goes on, "The eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then the lame shall leap like a deer, and the tongue of the speechless sing for joy." And as joyful and as life-affirming and life-changing as these events might be, Isaiah actually saves the best for last. He saves the most transformation at the end of his passage. The deepest root from which this outpouring of joy is drawn comes from the promise of God's return and redemption. And the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing. Everlasting joy shall be upon their heads, and they shall obtain joy and gladness. And sorrow and sighing shall flee away. So seriously, why does the world so often view followers of Jesus as the doom and gloom bunch, so full of woes instead of wonders? Why do we come off like people who are sad and gloomy and a real downer? If you are what you eat, as some argue, it seems often that followers of Jesus are eating too many prunes. Thank you. Look, when cynicism becomes more intelligent than joy, we have lost Advent to advertising. In truth, those who recognize what the season of Advent is actually promising are filled with more wonder and joy than any Christmas carol could ever possibly convey. Confounding expectations is the essence of what it means to follow Jesus. Wonder and joy is the perennial state of being for those who count themselves among Isaiah's ransomed and returned because of the new pathway that is about to be blazed into this world. The holy way that Isaiah described began to unfold and unfurl at the bedside of a baby in Bethlehem. And it continues to lead us toward a new life, a new Zion, every single year. If you can't leap for joy, just as the babe in Elizabeth's womb leapt for joy when he heard the news, then leap and dance like David did before the ark. Mary is the new ark. Both go into the Judean hill country for 3 months. Both contain the Holy of Holies. One, a stone tablet, a rod that sprouted almonds and manna. The other, the Word made flesh, the bread of life, the high priest who sprouts salvation on a tree. Rejoicing is at the heart of our faith. The act of joying and enjoying again and again and again. Following Jesus is to refuse to believe that joy is ever exhausted, no matter what. Or as Paul puts it in his letter of joy, Philippians, which he wrote, by the way, from prison, rejoice in the Lord always. And again I say, rejoice. This makes me think about the author Anne Lamott talking about her preacher. Her preacher would come to that verse and he'd say, if you're gonna rejoice, you gotta have some joice to begin with. You must have a reserve of joy to draw from in order to rejoice. Now the catch is, this thing called joy does not come from within ourselves. You can't manufacture joy. You can't buy joy. Joy doesn't come in a bottle or in a pill. Joy must be discovered, anticipated, reached for, leaned into. C.S. Lewis nailed it when he said, all joy reminds. It is never a possession, always a desire for something longer ago or further away or still about to be. And elsewhere when he wrote, all joy emphasizes our pilgrim status, always reminds, beckons, awakens desire. We have to understand, Paul in his letter to the Philippians does not tell us to always be joyful. That's impossible. And Paul himself was not always joyful. He was cranky at times, I find, in his writings. But Paul does point to the source where joy can always be found, in Jesus. Jesus always beckons us to follow him. Jesus always awakens in us a desire for that which was longer ago and further away, a garden where human beings lived in harmony with God's good creation, and for that which is about to be, a new heaven and a new earth where God dwells among the nations. Pain and death and prisons like the one Paul is writing from are no more, and God wipes away the tears from every eye. And Jesus bridges these two realities, the past works of God and the future, in his incarnation, his life, his death, his resurrection. The coming of Jesus awakens joy into human beings. In him, we are given a truer, better, and more beautiful sense of longing. We are never promised easy lives or lives without pain, but we are promised that none of those things will have the last word. The Gospel of John says, "The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it." In other words, Christ is the light of the world, and the very worst that the world can do is still not enough to extinguish that light. And if that light can't be extinguished, well, neither can our joy. And so here we are on one of the darkest days of the year, the shortest daylight that we get, the longest darkness. And we're here because somewhere inside of us, we believe that's true. We believe that the light will always overcome the darkness. And we believe in the miracle that is about to come into the world. Our calling as followers of Jesus is to live in that light, to spread that joy. Rejoicing is an act of deep faith. And spreading joy, living it out, is an act of revolution in a world that, quite frankly, could use a little joy right now. We're able to do this because we know that Jesus is near. We know that each day that passes brings us closer to the time when that light that's been steadily shining in the darkness will literally swallow darkness forever. And that is what Advent joy is about. It's a joy that consumes our lives so that we also become lights in the darkness that the darkness could not possibly overcome. And so as we continue to watch and wait in this season of Advent, let's be witnesses to the light of Christ and the joy that following Jesus brings. And let's live as people who believe that this joy, that this child who brings it, is literally going to change the world.